Chapter 12, Machine of World Domination. Europe, or more precisely, that part of Europe once known as the Western Roman Empire, which spread to include Ireland, Germany, Poland, Scandinavia, and Bohemia, affirms the machine. While in contrast, East Rome and later the Byzantine Empire persisted in a piety that remained dubious about mechanization per se, insofar as this region of the world, which was nevertheless permeated by the Greek mind, was spared the Ars Moderna, as well as the founding of universities and the printing of books. Even in the 17th century, people here were still discussing whether it was not a desecration to hand the Holy Scriptures over to a printing press, and thus to a machine. If Europe appears to us as the place where mechanization of the worldview started, identical with that occidental power structure today bearing this name, the idea that Gaul and Britain, let alone Barbaria and Germania, should become the stronghold of a flourishing culture would have seemed simply grotesque to a chronicler of late antiquity. Thus, after the Romans left in 410, Britain sank back into a lack of writing within two generations. Primitive wooden buildings took the place of Roman villas, and people stopped minting coins. With the decline in trade, industry, architectural finesse, and education, darkness settled over the vest of the empire, creating a state of historicity unparalleled in antiquity, and which has found curious expression in the Phantom Time debate. The notion that large parts of the Middle Ages did not take place at all. Though, in any case, the rise of Gothic Europe is a mystery. From the standpoint of civility, it would have been much more likely that the Byzantium or the Arab world would have taken a leading position here. After all, Eastern Rome was spared great political turmoil until the 7th century, and when parts of the empire had surrendered to the Arab host, the remnants of Greek education passed to the conquerors. If the Islamic world experienced its golden age in the newly founded Baghdad, it was not by chance that the Aristotelian logic, physics, metaphysics, rhetoric, and poetics were part of the Arab education canon. So why Gothic Europe of all places? And thus, the descendants of those illiterate Gothic tribes that had reduced Rome to rubble. The only plausible explanation is that the young people surrendered with Christianity to the culture of the machine. Within this thinking, in a subterranean way, questions survive that finally set in motion that profound process of cultural transformation that began with the Cistercian Gothic of the 11th century. This leads to a proto-capitalistic thinking, to banking, to mechanization, and to the central perspective. In short, to those socioplastic changes that we understand as initiating the modern era under the rubric of the Renaissance. In short, it is in Gothic Europe that the universal machine of writing is transformed into a radarwork, a wheelwork automaton, a socioplastic which succeeds in relocalizing the politics of heaven in the community. New time. One could understand the backwardness of the barbaricum as a catalyst, as a willingness to forget all of those survivors and remnants that resisted the design of a new world. This bath in the Lethe also succeeds because the view is not full of the legacies of antiquity, all of those statues of gods which are already presented in the writings of Augustine only as a grotesque cabinet. For example, when Augustine calls up the host of the gods that accompany the life of a Roman, Cadius, Felicitas, Lucina, Opus, Vaticanus, Quina, Rumania, and so on. Seen in this light, the darkness of the Middle Ages would be the very condition for the dawning of the new day to be felt not as a repetition, but as the beginning of a new time, Ars Moderna. new thinking. Strangely enough, and this makes the recasting process particularly difficult to decipher, this new thinking does not begin in the cities, but where one would least suspect it. Thus, the Cistercian order, which retreated into the woods for the sake of a new paradise, establishes a work ethic as a form of mediocrity. Because the monks are measured by their worldly accomplishments, the order begins to prosper in a way that is unprecedented in the worldly sphere itself. Whereas the Italian bankers in the 12th century were simple money changers doing their modest business on an open-air bench, the order had a network of branches throughout Europe, all of which followed the same architecture, socially and materially. As paradoxically as it sounds, the tendencies towards secularization can be traced first and foremost in the spiritual realm. There they affect not only the habitus and lifestyle of the clergy, but the doctrine of faith itself. When, for example, early 13th century transubstantiation doctrine asserts that in the Mass, the vine turns into blood, the wafer into flesh, the doctrine of the real presence of Christ seems like theological sophistry. As remote as the extremely popular disputations over the gender of the angels. If, on the other hand, it is understood as an attempt to establish the promise of the afterlife in this world, it becomes apparent that this transformation of essence goes far beyond the figure of Jesus. This is because the signals that from now on, society no longer wants to rely on abstract symbols, but on presence. Ens realisma, the real thing, the doctrine of transubstantiation, recorded at the Fourth Lateran Council in 215, is very soon followed by the golden missions of the 13th century. A strange fusion of these two spheres takes place. While the faithful in Gothic cathedrals celebrate their Savior in holy masses, they celebrate their worldly productivity in the masses before the sacred building. Artifacts of unprecedented sophistication. Since the double meaning of the word messa, mass, is not a coincidence but a part of the program, it's only logical that the various artisan trades give each other a sacred touch on the stained glass windows of the cathedrals. With this, the paintwork begins that double intellectual life. Formerly nothing more than the king's purse must dispose of the omnipresence and immortality of Jesus. With this miracle of transubstantiation, the corporation comes into being, allowing rulers the power of disposition over their subject stock exchanges, and legitimizes this from the highest authority, quod non caput Christus caput fiscus. What Christ does not catch, the treasury will snatch. Wherever a worldly interest is to be enforced, one invokes a higher authority. Following this tendency, a proliferation of the sacred takes place. Whoever claims rank in this world, be it a city, a university, or a monastery, begins to claim a saint for himself. The merit of these pretensions is obvious, for they confer higher consecrations on a worldly practice. However, there is a price to pay for this act of oratization. Not only did interest collection spread, but the mercenarianism replaced feudal warfare in the 14th century, as did the legitimization of prostitution, which became increasingly important with the advent of money and urbanization. For a time, attempts were made to maintain the fragile balance between this world and the hereafter using conversions and supporting constructions, be it by using prostitutes to finance sacred buildings, as Pope Clement did, or by monetizing sin itself through the sale of indulgences. However, this form of cohabitation leads into a world of irreconcilable contradictions in which the heteronomy of the two orders become more and more evident. Thus, Huizinga speaks of the fact that in the 14th century, one can assume a quasi-constitutional schizophrenia. In fact, schismatic tendencies were becoming increasingly inexorable. If the 14th century retrained God as a watchmaker, the apotheosis of the mechanical worldview could equally be used to prove the non-existence of God. Long before Columbus set out for crossing the Atlantic, Europe of the Middle Ages was already the new world that it would seek and find in America. Twilight of the Mind. Regardless of the material transformation of the medieval world, it takes centuries for the machine to become an incentive for self-deception. Thus, we take up the question raised in the introduction. How is it possible that the philosopher with whom the Cartesian worldview originates is several centuries late? And why does he convert the material machine into a metaphysical battery? Considering the distance traveled, this circumstance now appears far less enigmatic. For, as in the case of the alphabet, in the Weilwerk automaton, we have to deal with a thinking without a thinker, which, at the moment it comes into itself, strives above all to obscure the conditions of its possibility. As Plato denies alphabetic writing, so the prophet of the machine denies the fact that it came into the world long before him. Enthused by the structurally open possibility of the space of the universal machine, Descartes discovers what has been invented long before. Only because he knows himself to be in possession of the solution can Descartes, radically doubting, start that thought experiment which in the end amounts to the cogito, the thinking of the machine. So I will assume not the all-good God who is the source of truth, but some evil spirit, at once omnipotent and devious, has turned all of his diligence to deceive me. I want to believe that heaven, earth, colors, shapes, sounds, and all the external things are nothing but the deceptive play of dreams, by which he sets traps for my credulity. I want to look at myself as if I had no hands, no eyes, no flesh, no blood, no senses at all, but only falsely believed to possess all of this. Just as the atomists declare the external world to be illusory, Descartes places the sensory apparatus under general suspicion. And because the intellect is conversely given primacy, the material world is declared to be a symptom of the mind. Consequently, living beings appear as supposed natural automatons. The mastery of the celestial machine becomes the domain of philosophy. Machine Program. Just as Plato makes his logos the Treibwerk, or the engine of philosophy, through the apotheosis of writing, Descartes makes mechanics the engine of modern thinking. Both have in common that they use a universal machine for this metaphysical operation. Just as the alphabet can be used as an open order for anything imaginable, as phonetic writing, as logic, as mathematics, even as a socioplastic matrix, the Weilwerk automaton of the Middle Ages is also such an apparatus. Consequently, it appears in a variety of guises, whether as a clockwork, a power plant, or a process control tool that can be used to program events in time, in the form of a piece of music or in the shape of a group of figures moving to the hourly chime on the outside of a cathedral. The novelty of the Weilwerk automaton is that it expands the concept of the universal machine, so that the world can no longer be just deconstructed, but it can be programmed, meaning that its future states can be mentally anticipated. That this is possible is a result of using various natural resources, such as water and wind as in mill technology, but above all by the force of gravity, which, through the ingenious mechanism of escapement, allows the fall of a weight to be broken down into distinct impulses. So the inhibited fall of a weight or a suspended elongation of a spring can be used as a source of power. Or more generally formulated, the inhibited fall can be translated into a theoretically anticipated future. If the alphabet was a world-explaining machine, the wheelwork automaton is a world-programming machine. The constant expression of this thinking is the formulation that Pierre-Simon Laplace brought in his Traité de Mécanique Céleste, and which represents, as it were, the epitome, indeed, the historical goal of the Mathesis Universalis. If we knew the exact position and velocity of all celestial bodies in the universe, then we could project the future with certainty. If one does not want to be fooled by metaphysics, it is necessary to understand the machine in the Statin Ascendi, so as to capture that moment when it strikes like a small black comet in the thinking of the Middle Ages, and what does it leave behind? A stupor, a helpless obtuseness, which one only knows how to cope with by making the dear gods a watchmaker. Time is money. In the same way that the alphabet translates into a new socioplasty, programmable time flows into a new monetary and social order. Because in cathedral construction, which surpasses all ancient buildings in its structural finesse, the division of labor among the trades becomes a social fact. With the increasing fragmentation and interlocking of activities, planning, but also monetization becomes a necessity. And because the modularization of architectural and social space makes time, which has become punctual and ticks like a wheel, nervous, society is transformed into a pulsating whole that demands to grow beyond itself. In the croissades des cathédrales, the buildings increasingly look like launching pads that are supposed to propel the community of believers towards heaven, a movement of transcending boundaries that is reflected outwardly in the crusades, inwardly in the hectic urbanization. Bigger, higher, further. Top down. While earlier times erected their buildings by piling stone on stone, in the Gothic period the point of view changes. By inventing the cross-rib vault, which was first used in the monastic buildings of the Cistercians in the 11th century, the builders take the highest point and redirect the lines of force from there. In a sense, the building is created in the mind of the master builder, but this radically changes the character of the architectural design, because now this static logic gives the building its form. It can be read as an outsourcing of the inherent forces. Hence, the three-nave logic, the arcade and arched flying buttresses, the support pillars, and the like. If an ordinary wall would collapse under its own weight, the newly discovered system of space makes it possible to erect buildings with a minimum of materials, darting upwards into infinity with a grace never before achieved, dissolving into a light, diaphanous structure. Unlike Romanesque or ancient buildings, the Gothic cathedrals can scale. With the pride of the demiurge, the builder of the Chartres Cathedral, Villard de Honnecourt, leaves behind a labyrinth. Is it any wonder that his sketchbook contains an illustration of a perpetuum mobile? The proliferating signs. As mentioned previously, interest appears relatively early, even before the alphabetized ancient world created a significant literary culture. As remembered in the concept of the Toikazin, interest is understood from the beginning as a symbolic reproduction, because Toikazin stands not only for the production of interest, but, with Toikan, for the act of procreation itself. While interest may have been a widespread practice, it remains intellectually taboo. For, as Aristotle notes, it is impossible for sterile wealth to give birth to children on its own. This interest rate taboo, although constantly undermined, continues to have an effect into the Middle Ages. Here, too, everyone is convinced that the miraculous multiplication of money is deeply unnatural and, in any case, a sin, as society increasingly surrendered to the money economy as a result of the division of labor in the 12th and 13th centuries, an internal pressure arose to circumvent this problem. Sociologist Benjamin Nelson has traced this history in a dogmatic account of interest and made visible a shift in mentality that describes the birth of capitalism on the one hand and the metamorphosis of Christian morality on the other. The starting point is the Jewish belief that it is permissible to take interest from a goyim, but not from fellow believers. Since taking interest is perceived as a form of symbolic warfare, it goes without saying that the Church, in its Catholic universalist orientation, must run up a storm against this, or, at least, like Arab culture, strive to sweep the problem under the carpet. Since both are doomed to failure in view of the rampant money economy, church leaders feel compelled to envision forms of peaceful coexistence. The solution is to let the repentant users work off their sins in purgatory before they ascend to the kingdom of heaven. An elegant solution, if only because the work finally represents the path to salvation. This act of heavenly construction is just as revolutionary as retraining God as a watchmaker. Together, both signal the power of the social engine assumed in the 14th century, indeed to the extent of which proto-capitalism structures not only social practices but also articles of faith. Since the first steps have been undertaken to include the usurer, interest is transformed, pew to pew, into a self-evident institution, until finally, in Calvin's thinking, it rises to the rank of a civic duty from which only widows and orphans are to be exempt. If we keep in mind that Luther, following the chiastic logic, still understands money as a demonic anti-logos, money is the word of Satan, through which he creates everything in the world, just as God creates everything for himself through the true word. This exorcism, or more precisely, the silence of the demon, marks a true cultural change. Because with the interest and time, everything becomes nervous. Society submits to the culture of the machine. It is its engine, and no longer the spirit of charity, that pulsates in its heart. Under the hand. Nevertheless, what makes the study of this period both stimulating and complicated is that the new socioplasty emerges as a discursively untraced subversion or infiltration. So while the 14th century, faced with such disconcerting phenomena as inflation and rapid fluctuations in prices, it features countless treatises on the just price, but few texts addressing the issue of money on a systemic level. Insofar as the Middle Ages transformation takes place on the level of material culture, as in the form of cathedral building, issues of money, mechanical works and power machines, new techniques of paper production, in the textile industry, and a revolution in banking, but also in socioplastic institutions such as the guilds. While practical reason does not translate into a new worldview. New faces. Jacques Lugoff has told us about the intellectuals of the Middle Ages who complained that whenever they wanted to tell the world something new, that had never been said before, they had to put it into the mouth of one of the old masters. In the world of Ars Moderna, however, they say, I. Consequently, their portrayals, half-breasted views in front of a deep landscape, no longer show the typified human visage, but individualized portrait, so individual that every wrinkle of the face stands out. Sham production. In medieval painting, gold is used as a marker of the sacred. Conversely, the Renaissance theorist Leon Battista Alberti instructs painters not to create the glow of gold naturalistically, meaning not using actual gold, but instead through chromatic shadowed yellow tones. This reference is much more than an aesthetic advice. It stands for the end of a thinking that thought and analogies were paid like with like. This Greek substantialism let medieval optics explain the visual process with only a miraculous substance, an ethereal visual substance that envelops the viewed body and subsequently sends back a corresponding image, an eidolon, into the eye. There it is matched with a pre-existent set of ideas and identified as an object. This substance, as well as the matching ideas of that, take place in the brain, is eliminated with a central perspective, since now the rays of vision are conceived as impersonal entities thrown from a light source onto a sensitive surface. This does not necessarily have to be the eye of the beholder, but it can also be the projection surface of a camera obscura. Seeing is thus no longer an act originating in the eye of the observer, but fundamentally a mechanical process where the observer can be replaced by an optical apparatus. Thus, the interest-driven gaze is substituted by an intersubjective, objective machine. Following Jacob Burckhardt, who celebrates the Renaissance as the discovery of the world and of man, it has become commonplace to attribute the period of this discovery to subjectivity, a view that seems highly justified by the portraiture and realism given to the faces of the sitters. However, this classification overlooks the fact that the discovery of subjectivity is accompanied by the erasure, or the formatting of the subject. Following the dialectic of coin freedom, the price of this newly won freedom is that the gaze of the individual is subjected to the camera, the machine. In fact, subject and object gain their place and meaning only within the framework of the image under the condition of central perspective triangulation. In other words, you have to be in the picture to pass as a subject.
Drunk Tank.
If the 12th century still understands representatio as a directory of saved souls, which is kept in the Book of Life in Heaven, the term becomes increasingly sober. In central perspective, representatio becomes a grammar of visual transformation. The metaphysical attachments are stripped away until representation in the 17th century, in the thought of Thomas Hobbes, for example, means nothing more than the principle of substitution, mechanical triangulation.
State machine.
Van Karl Marx says that money wears uniform and national colors. He presupposes a nation structure whose necessity was already apparent in the monetary theory of Nicolae Resme in the 14th century, but only which emerges with all its power in the 17th century. The concept of the state itself, lo Stato, is a product of the Renaissance and refers to Italian republics of the 14th and 15th century, which can be viewed as laboratories of this development. On a small scale, orders are anticipated here that are not realized until the 17th century in the national monarchies of England and France. But how does it come about that power in the state stabilizes, even takes on a statutory form that the nation-state feels like a natural fact of life? As in the Greek polis, money plays an important, if not sufficient, role here. Although Florence issued its florin shortly after the consolidation of the Republic in 1250, the existence of the widely copied currency wasn't sufficient to establish it as a functioning polity. 100 years later, the city's economy was in such turbulence that the Peruzzi and Bardi banks, the pride of the city, collapsed in 1343 and 1346 respectively. What was the reason for this banking quake? In 1339, the year of hunger, the city had to borrow money for food imports, but also for mercenaries. Since the kingdoms of Naples and King Edward III of England had also borrowed money to finance campaigns, but were unwilling or unable to repay them, the ruin was inevitable. The collapse of the banks exposed the structural dilemma, namely that feudal polities, which were able to finance themselves only from direct taxes or monopolies, were not credible debtors, not merely because of a sudden emergency, but because the raison d'etre of the feudalist polity could not keep pace with the money economy. To remedy this lack of stability, a profound innovation occurred in Florence in 1427. The background was, as so often at the time, a military conflict, this time with the city of Milan. Since Florence was dependent on the English mercenaries, and the banking collapse of the last century was still remembered, they fell for the idea of making the city citizens pay for the financing, depending on their wealth. Such a general tax was unheard of because, until then, they had taxed certain goods or sold trade privileges. Now the city officials swarmed out and surveyed the financial circumstances of every Florentine, how many houses and servants he owned, and how many mouths he had to provide for. In short, the Florence of 1427 created a catasto that could be used to tax his subjects, and which still today, as a SQL internet database, provides insights into the financial circumstances of a good 60,000 Florentine citizens at that time. More interesting than this measure, however, was the fact that the city orchestrated this drastic, indeed downright violent measure with a parallel action. The gift of a fresco painted by the painter Masaccio in the Brancacci Chapel. In terms of content, the scene depicted referred to the biblical episode of tribute money, in which the temple guard asks Peter whether his master pays the temple penny. When he comes to Jesus, the latter forestalls his question by asking from whom the king of earth takes customs or taxes, from their children or from the strangers. Then he answered, "Of the strangers," Jesus said unto him, "so the children are free. But lest we give them offense, go to the lake and cast your line, and take the first fish that comes up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a 4-drachma piece. Take that and give it to them for you and me." Matthew 17, verses 17 through 24. It is not without a certain irony that the catasto executes exactly the opposite of what the biblical episode sets forth as the normal state. For now, to avoid causing offense, it is no longer the strangers who are taxed, but the children of the city. This establishes the principle of alterity, which Benjamin Nelson understands as a characteristic of capitalism. In contrast, the form that Masaccio's fresco gives to the episode souffles not the isolation, but rather the community-building aspect. For in the middle of the picture stands Jesus, surrounded by his disciples, while the handing of the tax debt takes place at the very edge of the picture. On the far left, Peter is seen fishing from a small lake for the fish in whose mouth the 4 drachma piece is found. The fact that the city is capable of such a feat virtually out of nothing marks the community-creating function of the image. Features not only as the first image in art history to be constructed in central perspective, but at the same time also represents the apotheosis of a community composed in central perspective. Superficially, the biblical episode appeals to a common faith, but its crucial message is that the glue of the commonwealth is money. Time is money. Just as the image of central perspective dissolves into individual pixels, so the proto-capitalist era, following the ticking of the mechanical clock, becomes increasingly alien. This strangeness accumulates in usury, where this engine of thought, according to which time has become nervous, must produce added value. Not everyone, however, is willing to make the sacrifices to this demon. In the Arab world, for example, the tabooing of interest decouples the individual and the machine from the culture of the machine completely. You don't even have to make cultural comparisons. Even in Europe, all the reservations that are being voiced in the Arab world are also being asserted. Thus, the usurer is called a time thief because he makes his money work not only at night, but also on the sacred Sunday, just as the doctores are accused of turning divine knowledge into money. Even in the 15th century, in the sermons of the Florentine penitential preacher Girolamo Savonarola, there are long passages castigating the painter's delusion of creation, releasing lifelike simulacra into the world, which nevertheless lack life. All of Savonarola's reservations can be traced back to a single argument, namely that the machine leaves nature behind, that it usurps the position of God. The culture of the machine. The consciousness of genetic power, that one does not shy away from releasing synthetic objects into the world. Stages of alienation. As an exemplar of how this paradigm shift plays out, let's take the incursion of the Weelwerk automaton into the medieval fabric of society. First and foremost, the Weelwerk drives clocks, musical chimes, and groupings of automaton figures in cathedrals. Then it is used in the tide mills, hammer mills, or paper mills. The strike of the hour synchronizes collective time. Thus, the mechanical clock becomes a social medium, creating a social meg machine structured like a Weelwerk. This is how working hours of industries with a high division of labor can be coordinated. For example, not only in cathedral construction, but also in the textile industry. At the same time, the phantasm of the corporation emerges, in which all elements mesh together like wheels of the clock. With this metricized piecemeal time, the money economy takes hold. If before the 11th century, people relied largely on natural currencies, occasionally even ghost currencies, and before that, Louis XI issued a gold currency in France, by the middle of the 13th century, a number of Italian cities also issued gold currencies. In general, hunger for money, usura or usury, flourishes. If these changes already entailed a considerable upheaval in the social fabric, with the founding of banks, guilds, and trading houses, the greater interconnectedness of society requires a stabilization of the money sector. In the middle of the 14th century, Nicolas Oresme wrote A Monetary Theory that addressed the dysfunctional coinage privileges of princes under the question, to whom does money belong? Because this leads to counterfeit kings buying up their neighbors' coins, melting them down, and throwing them into the market mixed with inferior metals, a downward spiral of devaluation occurs. A monetary limbo dance in which bad money displaces the good. A resume counters this with a central prospective monetary order, a central bank avant la lettre, in which the sovereign acts as the highest employee of the community. The Vilvark automaton, conceived as a universal machine, demands that society submits to its inherent logic, indeed, that it itself becomes a great Vilvark automaton.
Loss of substance.
As the veil of central perspective is placed over the world, the substance of things is being hollowed out. Whereas painters had hitherto assigned certain substantial qualities to colors, such as gold as a marker of the sacred, or purple as a sign of earthly dominion, it is now a matter of creating the appearance that one is dealing with this or that material. Consequently, even the ruler, according to Machiavelli, no longer has to be holy, but only appear holy. The fact that the values, depending on the situation, start to slip shakes the thinking of a time that deems the value of a thing as being incorporated within it. If medieval value stands equally for value and dignity, a split occurs. As a result, the activity of a general is not particularly highly valued in peacetime, but all the more highly in wartime. In the same way, the thing that is labeled with a price turns into a commodity, as does labor that is weighed in money. But how can a Christian price be established in times of monetary devaluation? In place of the immediate view and the immediate concept, a speculation takes place, the purely utilitarian functional consideration. This change is representative of a profound paradigm shift, away from antiquity's concept of substance to the modern concept of function. The departure from analogy is also reflected in mathematics. Until the 14th century, one could only count on proportions. But suddenly, the necessity arises to resolve the equation into a third, into a representative.
Debit and credit.
While zero was an intellectual taboo for which the Greeks did not even have a word, in the course of the 14th century, it became a matter of course. No, even more, the pivotal point of economic activity. In double-entry bookkeeping, which became widespread from 1340 on, the accountant recorded his income and liabilities, that is, his assets and his liabilities, in two parallel columns. If the difference between them was zero, the books were in order. Thus, zero marks the balance between debit and credit. Double-entry bookkeeping creates a space in which the focus is no longer on the interest of the trader, but on the transactions. Thus, in 1518, Matthias Schwarz, Jacob Fugger's accountant, can write in his Manual of Bookkeeping that double-entry bookkeeping is a mirror in which you see both yourself, questions, and answers. Representatio. Demonstrated in the famous Las Meninas painting by Velázquez, Michel Foucault, in his Order of Things, called modern thought a code of representation. Undoubtedly, the term is an apt characterization of that intellectual coordinate system in which painters transfer space to surface, mathematicians transfer geometric bodies to numerical quantities, and politicians finally transfer group claims to a central perspective set of rules. If one doesn't approach the term from the familiar modern side, it shows a strangely iridescent, even downright dismissive side. For in the Representatio of the 12th century, the Directory of the Saved Souls, the divine accounting of souls has not yet sobered up into otherworldly language of rule. This requires the miracle of transubstantiation, articulated in cathedral construction, in the money economy, and finally, in painting. Following the chiastic logic, earthly governors begin to usurp the divine prerogative. The dignitaries of the commonwealths are seen emblazoned with city key and book and pictures. To speak here of profanity or secularization fails to recognize that the divine aura is transferred to the inner world, as in heaven, so on earth. Consequently, the dual nature of Christ is transferred to human beings. If, on the one hand, they are still natural persons in their function as office bearers, they are regarded as chosen, like the king who acts as Jesus' representative on earth. If representation lends legitimacy to the new kinds of corporations, it is by no means mere appearance. With the central perspective, the Catasto, and the Florentine Republic, the rappresentare becomes a political logic that embeds the individual in a new kind of community structure, a logic that no longer functions as a divine ordo, but is inscribed in the polity, in an order of things. As in double-entry bookkeeping, debits and credits are juxtaposed here with citizens' rights and citizens' obligations. From this point of view, it is almost inevitable that the metaphysical attachments dissolve and that the terms in the 17th century should no longer stand for anything other than naked rule stripped of all metaphysics. Consequently, Hobbes calls his Leviathan, which is conceived according to the logic of the Veelvoet, a mortal god.
At zero.
Just as zero becomes the pivot of economic action in the 14th century, mathematics seeks to resolve the dilemma of analogy. That's why Nicolas Oresme not only comments on questions of money, but with the proportions of proportions outlines the longing and vanishing point of the perspective image, the possibility of being able to think of a new world. This is precisely the novelty of René Descartes. He demonstrates how geometrical questions turn into algebraic ones, how a geometrical body can become a number or a formula. With this, bodies are no longer conceived as prior entities, as in Plato's time, but as entities that owe their existence to machine construction. In this sense, the Pythagorean dictum, everything is number, has become a reality, the world more synthetico, no more than a creation of the mind. In the black hole. The Cartesian zero point does not mark the beginning of a new world, but rather the conclusion of a conception of a space, as announced long before in the system of space of the cathedral, cartography, and the longing point of central perspective. Formalization acts like a black hole in which the central a priori of the machine disappears. In this sense, Descartes proceeds no differently than the Docetists, who conceive of the world as a deception of a deceitful demiurge, whereas the immortal soul is ens realissimum. If one follows Descartes' line of reasoning, one runs the risk of losing oneself in a labyrinth stage reality, a staging whose goal is above all to make one forget the conditions of possibility. Just as Plato converts the historical fabric of the alphabetical sign into a divine DNA, Descartes turns the Veelvoet automaton into a metaphysical celestial machine, an artifice that ultimately amounts to a total amnesia, a bath in the Lethe. In contrast, the historical birth of the Veelvoet automaton is accompanied by the embarrassment that, although one is witnessing the unfolding of an intellectual space, one is not moving in the field of the history of ideas, but rather in an underground, almost subversive layer of reality. For as momentous as all of these developments are, even as political ideas in Vogelin's sense, they remain dumb, a thinking without a thinker, which only occasionally leaves a trace of a text, a splinter, or an ambivalent impression. It is, therefore, reality itself that forces discourse to reconsider. If the drive of the Wielwerk automaton clearly goes in the direction of that social dispositif which Foucault has called the code of representation, this drift nevertheless conflicts with the prevailing thinking in the Christian ideas, just as figures of thought from antiquity also play a role. Insofar, the discourses of scholasticism have no supporting, not even descriptive function. Rather, they function like defensive spells, as apotropaic gestures with which the Christian world arms itself against the innovations. Thus, in the 14th century, we find an endless mass of tracts dealing with the question of just price, but only one work that formulates the political question rather than appealing to morality. Because the changes are increasingly perceived as disruptive, even downright socially corrosive, a crisis ensues. The waves of anti-Semitism that swept across Europe in the 13th and 14th centuries, the civil wars and peasant revolts, the guerrilla of warring cities, the disintegration of the one and only saintly church, the confessional wars that drove Europe into the 30 Years' War, the war of all wars, against all. All this testifies to the clash of the driver, Treiber, and dispositif. When Cromwell gets his new model army in the mood for civil war with long prayer sessions about the exodus from Egypt, these religious outpourings are merely camouflage, a masquerade hiding the worldly, all too worldly claims to power. Socially speaking, the path that finds its mathematical redemption in Cartesian zero is a logic of annihilation, as if society could exorcise the ghosts of the past only through war, through annihilation, to the zero point, the moment of total exhaustion.
Among Lemmers.
If Descartes got to know the horrors of the 30 Years' War as a young soldier, three dreams would lead him to accept a universal method of investigating the truth. The first dream is one of anxiety, in which he walks through a lemur world but has enormous difficulty staying on his feet. In the second dream, he hears a thunderclap, and when he wakes up, he sees sparks of fire all around the room. In the last dream, he finds a book on his desk, which has been handed to him by a stranger. In a poem he reads the line, Quod vitae sectabor iter, which path of life do I take? Eventually, however, the book and the stranger disappear, and Descartes wonders whether what he has seen is a dream or a vision. The answer that his dream interpretation leads him to is reflected in his motto in life, Levatus pro Deo, I appear with a mask. He writes, just as actors, lest the blush of shame appear on their faces, put on a mask. So I enter this world theater in which I have hitherto been only a spectator with a mask. But the stage he enters is the world of the machine, and the drama given here is the unfolding of pure reason. And because everything has to go through pure thought's eye of the needle, there is not even a memory of the world that has been eradicated. Insofar, it's consistent that Descartes calls living beings natural automata, constructs of mechanical reason. Perfect machines. Leibniz writes, thus, every organic body is a kind of divine machine, or something like a natural automaton, infinitely surpassing all artificial automata. Because a machine created by the art of man is not a machine in every one of its parts. For example, the tooth of a brass wheel has parts or fragments that are no longer physical for us and have nothing about them that distinguishes the machine in terms of the use for which the brass wheel was intended. But the machines of nature, that is, the living body, are still the smallest parts.